I'm Seattle Times political reporter Jim Bruner.
And I'm Seattle Times City Hall reporter Dan Beekman. Let's talk politics. Welcome to episode 56 of The Overcast, the Seattle Times weekly politics podcast.
This week, we talk with Seattle Times environmental reporter Linda Mapes, who walked us through some natural calamities that have befallen the Pacific Northwest involving salmon, Pacific and Atlantic, and the marten, which seems to be disappearing from the Olympics. We talked to Linda about why this is happening, whether it's all linked, and what can be done about it. If you've been reading the Seattle Times lately, you've seen some disturbing news about the Puget Sound ecosystem. Got 100,000 Atlantic salmon escaping their pen. Scientists hauling survey nets off the Washington coast find some of the lowest number of Chinook salmon in decades. And meanwhile, in the Olympic Mountains, scientists are wondering, where have all the martens gone? They seem to have all but disappeared. Is climate change a common thread here, or what's going on? Seattle Times environmental reporter Linda Mapes has covered all these stories in recent weeks, and she's joining us to help sort this out. Thanks, Linda.
Glad to be here.
So, Linda, let's start with the mammals. I think not all podcast listeners know what a marten is. Can you explain what the martens are, these little mammals, and their habitat?
So let's start with the spelling, M-A-R-T-E-N. Martens are a beautiful little animal. They're quite small, actually, only about 2 pounds. So think about your house cat, and it's half the size of that, or even a quarter, depending on your cat. They have a beautiful, lustrous brown coat and sweet little round ears and a very bushy tail, actually. So picture a fox, but smaller. And these animals are in the weasel family, so they're in the same family as much more common animals in our woods, such as the wolverine and the mink. They're often mistaken for mink. But martens are posing quite a mystery for scientists, because while they're still here, they're everywhere in the Cascades, they're actually a very common sighting, something's going on in the Olympics. These animals are native to the Olympics, and we know from trapping records that they certainly used to be there in some abundance, but something's happened. In hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of wildlife camera surveys, remotely triggered cameras that are triggered both by heat and by motion, there has not been more than one sighting of a marten in recent years. And so scientists are trying to figure out just exactly what's going on. Why do these animals seem to be present in one of their home ranges, but seemingly largely absent in the other? They're all over the Cascades, but you can't find them in the Olympics.
Okay. What's different about the Olympics versus the Cascades in terms of the environment?
There's one crucial difference. The Olympics are an island. And for that reason, it means that if you lose populations, either because of overtrapping or illness or some other mishap, it's going to be harder for more animals to disperse to diversify and build up that population. And so that physical fact of the Olympic Mountains is a kind of a, you know, barrier, if you will, for recovery to animals that become depleted. But secondly, there's something very different going on with the snowpack. So this is an animal that thrives and depends and is beautifully adapted for deep, deep snow. While other animals can't even negotiate once the snow really stacks up 12 feet high, this is an animal that thrives because it means it can evade predators, because they can shoot over the snow like a rocket to go get a snowshoe hare. They can chase down animals living in their little subnivian world of deep winter voles and mice in their little tunnels. But you know, snow has been come and go on the Olympics in a way that we haven't seen in the Cascades. There was a complete and total lack of snow in 2015. So the dramatic come and go of snow in the Olympics is one of the things scientists are looking for. And don't forget, in the future with climate change, one of the things that's predicted in both the Olympics and the Cascades is more rain and less snow. So, you know, this is another aspect that scientists are looking at as they wonder what's really going on with this animal.
And was this a sudden crash? Or you described, scientists have been out there for some time. Maybe describe a little bit who the scientists are and what they're doing. They set up a whole bunch of remote cameras all throughout the woods and the mountains to track not just martens, I take it, right? A lot of species.
Correct. They're looking for carnivores of various kinds, especially wolverines. And, you know, this is one of those things where in the process of looking and finding those animals, they began to realize, but where are the martens? You know, we're seeing in these surveys this whole beautiful suite of animal life in the Olympics, and an absolute menagerie of animals, everything from spotted skunks to cougars and bears and, you know, just everything you think should be there, big and small, except for martens.
And besides them being cute and cool to see when you're hiking, why does it matter if they're gone? Does that lead to some ripple effect in the environment and the habitat for others?
For sure. I mean, in nature, everything is there for a reason. Everything has its niche. And to the extent that you can have the complete suite of life, that is the preferred condition. And to the extent that you don't, inevitably, there are consequences not only for the animals out there, but for us. If there's something wrong with the habitat, say climate change, probably that's not a non-issue for us either. And in that way, animals are an early warning for us. We're animals too. We need a functioning natural world. And to the degree that animals aren't doing well, it's something that we need to pay attention to also. But there's also a philosophical and a moral point. These animals have a, if you will, right to be there. They're supposed to be there. They always have been there. And if there's something going wrong, that matters.
What's the state or what's any governmental agency, the county, what are governmental agencies doing about this issue?
Well, the Forest Service has been heavily involved. It's their biologists who have been out and about putting up these cameras. And I want to mention an innovation that they're deploying, which they're pretty excited about. Now, these cameras, they're out there in the wilderness, and they're not just waiting for animals to, you know, maybe come by. They put up a scent lure to draw animals to the camera. Now, it used to be that these scent lures would be nice and stinky and delectable for 3-4 months, but then ultimately the attractant would disperse and wear out. However, some smarties over at Microsoft came up with a whole new kind of dispenser, which is constantly dripping out just a little bit at a time of this unbelievably smelly stuff. It's like a wall. When you smell it, it's like hitting a wall. Think skunk, add rotten egg. Then this new continually stinky lure means that during the winter time, the deep snow time, when you're most likely to see animals like wolverines and marten, this thing will keep working, whereas in the past, scientists couldn't get in there to replace the lure.
Well, that's really interesting. What is Microsoft doing developing a lure for martens and other animals? I mean, was it originally intended to attract techies to Redmond, or how did that come about?
I love that question. Microsoft does a surprising amount of environmental work. As the environmental reporter at the paper, I've been often surprised at just how much work they're up to with regard to climate change, carbon sequestration. In this instance, this was just a good guy volunteer thing. They deployed some of their people to get on the stick and try to figure out something in partnership with the senior conservation scientist actually at the Woodland Park Zoo. More and more, these wildlife efforts, all sorts of environmental efforts, are collaborations between agencies, nonprofits, and businesses. It's interesting to see these new partnerships forming and taking on all kinds of new questions in new ways.
Okay, so martens definitely something to keep an eye on, and Microsofties as well. But let's move from the mountains to the ocean and rivers. Linda, you reported recently that scientists conducting annual surveys found their nets empty, literally empty of salmon off the Washington-Oregon coasts. Can you describe that survey? What was disturbing about the results? They got a lot of fish, other fish, just not salmon, right?
Exactly. You know, I'm not really used to hearing scientists talk in these sorts of terms. Usually everything is sort of qualified, and it's maybe this, or it's maybe that, and it's probably okay, or maybe it isn't. Man, so I talked to the scientists involved in this survey, which has been going on for 20 years off the Washington coast, and this one scientist said to me, you know, we took this trawl, and we towed it up to 45 nautical miles offshore, and we towed it once. And we towed it twice, and we towed it a third time, and it came up absolutely empty. And he said they were so freaked out by this, they thought maybe there was something wrong with the equipment. And then they went further north. The survey, by the way, goes from Nia Bay all the way down, about halfway down the Oregon coast. So they headed further north, and suddenly they start catching things. But it's the wrong things. Instead of these juvenile salmon, which is what they're fishing for, they start getting all these tropical species, warm water species, fish that aren't supposed to be there. And the reason for that is we had this gigantic mass of warm water in the ocean, which everyone called the blob, sort of the perfect name for it. You know, that started forming back in 2015, and it's since dispersed. However, all of the animals that came here on that nice warm tide, animals out of place, they're still here. And that's having a ripple effect on the ecosystem. And one of the things these scientists said to me was they really are worried that they see something way beyond just the typical swings in ocean conditions that we're all used to, you know, good years, bad years. This seems to be a much more profound shift in the ocean. Everything from forage fish to how fatty the plankton is to the presence of animals that are supposed to be here and the absence of animals that are supposed to be here has them concerned that we're looking at something bigger.
Let's talk about, I mean, what do these juvenile salmon need to survive and what is missing? You mentioned plankton. I think there's some small crustaceans too that were mentioned in your story that have been depleted or eaten by other fish?
Well, that's what's so interesting. In the environment, everything is always connected to something else, which is why the martens matter, back to that idea. But, you know, in the ocean, what's going on is now you have depressed levels of what are called forage fish. These are these wonderful, fatty, delicious fish that everything else eats, anchovies, that sort of thing. Well, the numbers of those fish are very low right now. And so two other factors. One is you still have the same numbers of seabirds and they've got to eat. And so the concern is that sooty shearwaters and other sorts of seabirds are now eating juvenile salmon instead. Secondarily, remember those fish I told you that are here that are not supposed to be here, such as mackerel? Well, they eat salmon. And so they have both a direct and an indirect effect on juvenile salmon. Number one, preying on them, actually eating them. And number two, eating the things that juvenile salmon need to eat. And so it's both a competitive and a predatory interaction. There was an interesting corroborating piece of evidence that points to something very disturbing going on in the ocean, which is that surveys that went on in the estuary at the same time didn't turn up skinny fish. So that, to the scientists, meant that it's the food web in the ocean that's being disturbed. This isn't happening in the river. It's not happening in the estuary. It's happening in the ocean. And what that points to is a very large ecological system that we can't control that is moving on in its own way in response to this big blob of warm water.
So this isn't something that can be changed just by taking out a dam or something like that. This is out there in the Pacific.
This is out there in the Pacific, and what that points to is the imperative of doing better with what we can control. That is the freshwater environment that we're part of. You know, if you know you're going to be facing these absolutely terrible conditions in the ocean, that means you better do the best you possibly can in the freshwater. It's the one vagary that you can have a little bit of control over. And I think that the thing we have to remember, too, is that this isn't just one year that we're going to have results of this terrible situation in the ocean. Remember, these are out-migrating juveniles that they're finding very, very few of coming from the Columbia River system. What's that mean? That means that 2-3 years from now, when those animals are supposed to be coming back as nice, fat, sleek adults to feed, say, endangered orca whales, they're not going to be there. And we're already seeing a 30-year low in population of orcas. Some of those animals actually have starved to death. And so it's really, honestly, kind of the worst possible news.
It's very depressing to think about the ripple effects, like you said, you know, with the marten in the mountains and the salmon in the ocean.
Yeah.
What is, again, to the point, you know, you said that we can do something about the freshwater aspect. So what is the state alert to this? Is Governor Jay Inslee or others, are they taking any action? Have they done enough?
With regard to that, you know, I've been covering salmon in the Northwest for 20 years, and some of the problems that I've been writing about are still there, relatively unaffected 20 years later. Things such as development have only become more of a challenge for salmon. Here in the Puget Sound region, obviously, the whole press is for even more development, and not only in Seattle, but out where the forests still are, because people can't afford to live here. They're going further and further out into the hinterlands. And we're building, you know, rail systems further and further out into the suburbs to press more and more people further out. And, you know, we're still losing forest cover when we know that forests are the one thing that hold the soil and soak up the rain and you know, take care of these ecosystems by keeping forests, and yet we're still losing them. It's not like we don't know what to do. We know perfectly well what to do. And the Snake River Dam issue, my goodness, that's been around as long as I've been writing about salmon. And, you know, we've been through 5 biological opinions, which is the document that the federal agencies have to clear a legal bar on before they can sign off on running the hydropower system in the Columbia River without killing off threatened and endangered salmon. We've 5 times been before federal courts on that document, and 5 times it's been kicked out saying, no, this is inadequate. And most recently, a federal judge has said, you know, actually, it's time for a complete do-over on the science that you guys keep bringing us. And this time you have to put dam removal on the table, and you have to put this in the context of climate change. So, you know, you ask me, are they doing enough? They're spending a lot. I mean, untold amounts of money. But fish don't lie. Yeah. They're not there.
But every Eastern Washington and, you know, Northwest member of Congress, I'm sure, is thrilled about the prospect of dam removal, right?
We've only seen it once, and that was on the Elwha River, and it took 20 years to do it, and that was the original no-brainer. I mean, you had one customer for the electricity, the power was easily replaced, and yet it still took 20 years, and you know, you'd think we were taking down the pyramids of Giza. And it's been a fantastic success. I mean, everything from the birds to the bugs to the fish are just booming back, and it's only been 5 years, you know, and yet, you know, at the end of the day, what's needed is just a nice, rational discussion. Remember those about costs and benefits. You know, there are dams out there that are deadbeat dams. They don't do anything for anybody, and they're killing off ecosystems. Why are they still there? Why are we even still talking about it?
We won't have that discussion on Twitter, though. I don't think it.
It definitely takes more characters than that. But, you know, the Elwha, the main product of the Elwha and that really unique act in all of the world, no one's ever done anything on that scale for fish recovery, for ecosystem recovery, is hope that change is possible and it does make a difference. And so we should take that example. And the main thing to take from it is a rational process. You know, look at dams, and some of them provide so much benefit, of course, we should keep them. Others, it's not even close.
So we've just been talking a lot about our ecosystems here in our area, how things are supposed to be, and the absences of some animals that are supposed to be there. But what about these Atlantic salmon from a whole different ocean that are being brought over here and farmed in our waters? We have not enough of the salmon that are supposed to be here, and now do we have too much of the salmon that aren't supposed to be here? What's going on with those?
So this has been incredibly controversial, just to catch people up on it. So we had this gigantic net pen failure in Puget Sound over the weekend at the end of August, right before the solar eclipse. I'll come back to why that matters in a second. And so you've got this company called Cook Aquaculture, which is based in Atlantic Canada. So it's a foreign corporation. It's a $2 billion corporation. They operate in many countries. They are the largest farmer of Atlantic salmon in the Northern Hemisphere. So a big company, and they, a year ago, bought all 8 operating aquaculture, net pen aquaculture, Atlantic salmon farms in the state of Washington. A lot of people didn't even know we had Atlantic salmon farms.
And what does that mean exactly? Is it just mean that there's an underwater net and you dump fish in it and they live there?
You got it. You know what a cattle feedlot looks like. Well, this is the waterborne version. It's a pen sitting in the water, and they fill it full of fish, in this case 305,000 fish, and they're called grow pens. They put them in there a little, and they grow them big, and when they're 8 to 10 pounds, they harvest them. And they, in this case, the company mostly sells to distributors. You're not going to walk into your local grocery store and pick up one of these fish. They mainly are distributed to restaurants and other places. But, you know, the thing that happened that was so wild was this fish farm escape happened over the weekend. It started on a Saturday, and the fish farm, which is up in Cypress Island, which is in the San Juan Islands, absolutely just blew apart on a Sunday. And all of a sudden, like 100,000 of these fish go out into the water. And I didn't hear about it until Tuesday, when I get a call from a Lummi native fisherman saying, hey, I'm catching Atlantic salmon in my nets. And so I call up WDFW thinking, really, could that possibly be right? The guy's got pictures. Maybe he's right. And like, finally, on Tuesday afternoon, I get a press release from WDFW saying there's been this fish farm escape. It isn't until Wednesday morning that Cook Aquaculture finally makes a statement to the public. They'd been talking to their regulators, but not to us, about what happened. And you know what they said?
They blamed the eclipse, didn't they? How did that go? That was a strange situation.
It's well, like,
look up in the sky and blame the eclipse.
It gave the story a lot of clicks, that is for sure. Clickbait for sure. Just blame it on an eclipse and you'll get a lot of readers. But it wasn't true is the problem there, because the tides were no different. You know, they said there were these massive solar eclipse-driven tides. And instantly, you know, we live in geek world here in Seattle. And, of course, instantly there were like 50 people stuffing my inbox with these hostile messages saying, you idiot, just look at the tide charts. Look at the data. The tides were actually less than usual. And sure enough, they were totally right. And the company backed off of that statement. And it got worse. You know, they said, oh, no, there were only 4,000 fish that got out. And this is primarily a business loss. And I'm thinking, you don't know where you are. Because, of course, in the Pacific Northwest, an escape of invasive Atlantic salmon is going to be a big, huge, hairy deal. And people were completely freaked out about it. Tribal governments, conservationists. I mean, this has been a gigantic story, and it's still a big story, and it should be a big story because it raises a good question. Why are we even doing this? California bans it. Alaska bans it. Oregon doesn't have it. And here's Washington State. It's only 80 jobs. You know, it's a foreign-owned corporation. They've only been here a year. And this has brought a big outcry from tribes and others to shut it down, make it go away.
What's so damaging about having the Atlantic salmon swimming around in the Pacific? What is the problem?
Are salmon?
Here's the concern. So these animals got out at a very sensitive time. They happen to spill out into the water just when the native Pacific salmon are coming back to their home waters. And remember those juvenile salmon I was talking about? This is when they're supposed to be out in the estuary, milling around, feeding, getting ready to go make their big trip out into the ocean. And so here come the Atlantics. And so the concern is manyfold. One, that they could bring disease, another that they would compete for food, another that they would compete for habitat, another that they'll replicate, that they'll breed with one another. Or the big horror idea is that they would actually interbreed with the Pacific salmon. Now, that has never happened to anyone's knowledge, but it has happened in Canada that these animals have been able to, you know, breed amongst themselves.
Why would that be so horrible?
Because they're not supposed to be here. And they would compete for habitat and space with the Pacific salmon that are struggling. And you know, we have spent untold amounts of money trying to pump up these populations of native salmon, and instead they just keep cratering. And you have other animals out there, such as orca whales, that have got to have Puget Sound Chinook. They won't eat anything else, and they're literally starving. And the last thing you need is yet another stress, another challenge in this already struggling ecosystem.
Yeah, this was a big outcry, and yet despite that, more recently reported that the state okayed 1 million more farmed fish for Puget Sound. I think this despite Governor Jay Inslee saying, you know, declaring, you know, making a big deal about we won't allow any new pens, but then comes along a permit application. I guess it had already been submitted, so that maybe it's not a new permit, but 1 million more fish. What happened there, and could the state have stopped it?
This really raises eyebrows. So the state is still in the investigative stage of, you know, looking at this accident and what happens. And Cook comes along and says, well, got 1 million fish down in our hatchery in Rochester, and it's time for them to move on to salt water. And it's true, there's a biological clock that ticks in these fish, and there's a point at which they have to make it to salt water or their whole process changes. They become a different kind of animal. And so Cook wrote to the state and said, you know, all we need for that is certification from WDFW that these fish are disease-free. Period. That's all that's required under law. We can certify that they're disease-free, and we want to move our fish. And WDFW came back last week and said, well, actually, you know, we don't have any legal basis by which to deny this permit. And so they said, okay, you know, you can move your fish. And Governor Inslee had asked them to hold off on that. He had asked them to find another place for them. And the company said, you know, we don't have to hold off on it. We don't want to hold off on it. We don't have any place to take him, and we're moving him to our farm. We have to be able to continue business as usual, basically. And they lawyered up, of course, here in Seattle. And, you know, they're pressing their interest. And the state is so far been kind of, what shall we say, unable to do what perhaps they politically would like to do. And it's interesting because the Department of Natural Resources Remember, that's a separate entity from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife with an independently elected statewide official, Hillary Frantz, the commissioner, has taken a somewhat different path. I mean, she has stated publicly on several occasions that she has, quote unquote, grave concerns about whether raising these non-native salmon are in the state's best interest, number one. Number two, she has ordered inspections of all of these facilities, all eight of them, to determine that they are in good working order. And she came out just yesterday with a finding that the pen that they're stocking with these million more fish, while structurally sound, has issues. There's
like a hole in the net,
yeah,
right?
A hole in the net. There's a so-called predator net that encircles the farm that's supposed to keep out animals that would eat the fish. It has a hole in it. And there's a lot of corrosion topside. And she told me that her plan is to very aggressively do as much as she can to make sure that while these things are still here, that they're operated in a safe manner.
Could we see the next session of the state legislature or something come along to try to do what Alaska and California have done and ban this kind of farming?
Count on it. Senator Ranker out in the San Juan Islands has already said that he intends to bring back a piece of legislation that he considered some years ago, which would ban net pen aquaculture of Atlantic salmon in the state of Washington. And the tribes, that would be all of the tribes in western Washington with treaty rights to fish, have demanded a ban on net pen aquaculture in Washington. And I would not be at all surprised to see a lawsuit coming from tribes saying that these fish are damaging their treaty-protected fisheries. So I think we'll see much more of this story in the weeks and months to come. It's far from going away.
And you have a new story, as I understand it, sounds really fascinating. It's not online as we speak, but by the time this podcast, people are listening to it, I think it will be out. This involves the company trying to sway the tribes to back off political pressure, at least one of the tribes. Can you tell us what happened there?
This is a really interesting behind-the-scenes story. So while this was going on, that is to say these escaped fish are out there in the water, the Lummi Nation, which is up there by Bellingham, and this happened in their ancestral waters, they actually enacted an emergency fishery. They dropped everything, and they got fishermen out on the water to try to mop up as many of these fish as they possibly could. And that was very expensive for them, and it took fishermen away from the catches they would usually be trying to get at that time. And nobody wanted to buy these fish, by the way. And so the tribe felt that they had to spend their own money to buy these fish so that they could create a market, if you will, for them, so that their fishermen would go out and get them. And they said that the state's response had been wholly inadequate, that Cook's response had been wholly inadequate. And if anybody was going to get these fish out of the water, it was going to have to be them. So they stepped up, they spent the money, they got their guys out there, and they worked tirelessly to catch as many of these things as they could. And indeed, they caught 400,000 pounds of these fish. Other non-tribal fishers also pitched in and caught fish, but mainly it was the effort by tribes, and specifically the Lummi, that got as many of the fish as they could out of the water. Well, so I wrote about all that and put pictures in the paper of it and so forth. What I didn't know was that behind the scenes, Cook was sending letters to the Lummi Nation saying, hey, you know, we'll pay you $30 a fish for your effort, but if you will remain silent on the idea of either phasing out or banning net pen aquaculture, we'll pay you $42 a fish. And the Lummi Nation wrote back saying that they were insulted at this effort to buy their silence, and that they had absolutely no desire to make any arrangements or deals with Cook Aquaculture, because they were also offering all sorts of other alliances and ongoing relationships and so forth. And the Lummi Nation said, you know, we don't want any of that. In fact, $30 doesn't even begin to cover our costs, but we'll take that. And don't think for a minute that it ends further discussion of what it will take for us to feel that we've been made whole for this disaster. And so that was a pretty interesting behind-the-scenes dynamic, and I didn't know about it until I got the letters from the tribe yesterday.
Okay, Linda, so we've gone through Martin's, local Pacific salmon, and Atlantic salmon. What's the common thread here? What should we be taking away from all of this and thinking about as we go about our daily lives in the Pacific Northwest?
You know, I think what I would say about that is that nature is our teacher. That it's not just sitting out there as scenery or a passive recreational opportunity. You know, nature is telling us the health of our world, the state of our world. And when you have situations where animals that are supposed to be there aren't, or animals that aren't supposed to be there are there by, you know, the millions, you should be asking yourself, what's going on. And don't go to sleep. Don't think of nature as just a postcard or a hiking destination. It is, in fact, the world in which we are embedded. And to the degree that nature's doing well, we'll do well too. To the degree it's not, we won't either.
Thanks very much, Linda, for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
That's a wrap for episode 56 of The Overcast. Thanks to our guest, Linda Mapes. Thanks again to KNKX for having us in the studio to record. We should mention that Linda has written a book called The Witness Tree, which tracks climate change as seen through one grand oak. And she's doing a reading of that book and a talk at the Royal Room in Columbia City on October 17th. She'll also be at Ampersand Live at the Moore Theater on October 26th.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on Twitter at @Jim_Bruner, @DBeekman. Email us at cltimesovercast@gmail.com. Call and leave us a voicemail at 206-464-8778. Please subscribe and review us on iTunes. You can also hear us on TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.
And until next week, have a cloudy day.